At the roof of the world are the Himalayas. I'm Scott Carrier, and you're hearing voices from NPR, the best of public radio. This next hour, we'll travel to the town of Siklis in Nepal. But first, we'll climb the Tibetan plateau circling Mount Kailash, sacred to Hindus and Buddhists.
At 15,000 feet above sea level, Lake Mansarovar in western Tibet is the highest freshwater lake in the world. In mid-afternoon, it's exceedingly bright, and there are no trees, so the only way to escape the sun is by closing your eyes. And even then, you can still see. The name Mansarovar means consciousness lake, as Hindus believe it to be a manifestation of the mind of Brahma, the creator of the universe. The water is dark blue, black in places where wind is skimming over the surface. The sky is also dark blue, nearly black. 100 miles to the south, cumulus clouds are rising over the Himalayan crest line, clouds that were born in the Indian monsoon, fat with water, but somehow made it up and over the highest mountains in the world and are now exploding with power in the thin air of the Tibetan plateau. Hindus also believe that anyone who goes swimming in this lake will have all his sins or her sins erased. But I tried it already, and I don't think it worked. Maybe if I were a Hindu. Maybe if I were a cloud. This morning I got up early, went for a walk, and saw some nomads who'd spent the night beside the lake. They were an extended family with grandparents and babies, pilgrims from some other part of Tibet, come to walk around the sacred mountain, Mount Kailash, just 10 miles to the north. The sun had come up but was buried behind heavy clouds, and there were 3 inches of new snow on the hills above the lake. It was cold, and I was watching the nomads take down their canvas tents. They pulled the stakes, took out the center and corner poles, and tossed the canvas in the back of the Chinese cargo truck they were all traveling in. And then there was nothing left to pick up or put away. They had no stuff, no gear. They'd slept in their long coats or chupas on the bare ground, and their chupas were filthy with dirt and grease, as were their hands and faces. They looked like homeless people, but they've lived here for thousands of years. At 22,000 feet above sea level, Kailash is far from the highest mountain in western Tibet, but it sits alone and has a magical shape, 4 sides like a pyramid or the top of a diamond, covered in snow and ice. The Sanskrit word Kailash means crystal, and Hinduism holds that it is the physical manifestation of the mythical mountain Sumeru, the great mountain at the center of the universe and the navel from which all creation springs forth. They believe Lord Shiva lives on the summit, locked in sexual embrace with his consort, Shakti. Their dance pushes the circle of life, and when they stop dancing, the world will explode. For Tibetan Buddhists, the mountain is home to many deities, including the Tantric Buddha, the Supreme Bliss Machine Buddha, Chakrasambhava. Beside the lake shore, there's a pointed butte, the front side shaped like a cone, 300 feet tall. Near the top, there's a rock outcrop, and inside the rock, there's a small cave. An old monk with a flashlight lets us in. This is where Padmasambhava, one of the saints who brought Tantric Buddhism to Tibet, is said to have meditated more than 1,000 years ago. My friend Lisa has a video camera, and she's taping these kids with the screen turned around so they can see themselves. We're in Darchen, the village at the southern base of Mount Kailash, where you start walking the kora, or circuit, around the mountain. The houses are made of adobe bricks that are the same color as the road. They have low, flat roofs made from wooden beams imported from Nepal. Inside, they lay sheets of linoleum over compressed dirt floors and cook on sheet metal stoves that burn chunks of dried yak dung. The motorcycles going by are all Chinese four-strokes with roll bars and wind fairings and mud flaps, fake snow leopard skin seats, decorated with flying tassels and painted with eternal knots, swastikas, lotus blossoms, and flames. The riders are young men with yak bone berets in their hair, wearing leopard skin cowboy hats, red vests, turquoise necklaces. They look like mob gauchos, but they're yak herders, yak boys, come to town on their ponies. In the middle of town, there's a row of shops where you can buy last-minute items for the hike. Barley flour or sampa, Snickers bars, beer, cigarettes, pots and pans. In front of the shops, out in the open air, there are a couple of pool tables. One with a four-year-old girl up on top, dancing and dropping balls while her friends shoot around her. We begin the kora, the pilgrim's path, clockwise around the mountain, falling in on the trail with some nomads, 25 yaks, and a few horses. Some of the yaks wear prayer flags and have ribbons braided into their hair. Others carry loads. One girl has a white lambskin hat shaped like a tall coffee cup and a white coat with bells on the fringes. This man has an amulet around his neck and a long knife around his waist. I ask him a question through our guide, and he looks at me like I'm a talking shoe.
Where are you going with your yaks today?
He says they're from down by the lake, and they're walking around the mountain, practicing their religion just like they always do and always have done. Then he stoops down and picks up a dried yak dung off the trail and puts it inside his coat, or chupa. You couldn't live here without yak dung. You'd freeze and starve to death. I can see the trail going up the canyon maybe 2 miles ahead of me, and also 2 miles looking back from where we came. The canyon is a half pipe, a mile wide and a half mile high. The people spread out along the trail look like little beetles, maybe 80 to 100 in all. I guess that half are foreigners from Europe, Japan, India. The other half are Tibetan nomads.
So, where are you from?
Kanelenza.
This man, Zeyan Dorji, is a nomad from Nabri, 400 miles to the east. He says he came here in the back of a cargo truck with his wife and children and grandchildren, 11 in all.
Why did you want to come here? Why did you want to come to Mount Kailash?
They came to purify negative karma by praying for all sentient beings under the six realms of existence.
And how's it going? How is your trip going so far?
He says, basically, I'm 61 years old and it's pretty hard. Maybe because I have bad karma from killing so many animals in my lifetime.
Do you think that your life will be different after you complete this trip? You think you will change?
No, he says. This is not for this lifetime. This lifetime, I'm a poor nomad. But if I purify my karma, then maybe in the next lifetime, I won't have to be mean to animals. This is not for now, but when I die, it will help. Most of the foreigners walking around the mountain have hired porters to carry their backpacks. At $10 a day, it's a good deal, considering the elevation and the distance.
You see these prayer flags here? This is a.
But this man, Paul Garden from Norfolk in England, is carrying his own load, which only amounts to some food and a sweater stuffed inside a Tibetan chupa. This is his eighth time around the mountain.
But the tradition is to do it 13 times.
Oh.
So this is the goal. It's taking me 2 days each trip to get around. Once I did it in 1 day, but I think once was enough. Huh. Yes, there was a bit of a Forrest Gump day. I just couldn't stop. I was full of adrenaline or something. It's like I can walk for hours on end and I'm only really present to the silence here. You must have noticed the profound silence in this place. It's like walking through a dream here. I've studied yoga in India for years. I'm kind of drawn that way anyway.
So is this like yoga, is walking around doing
the course? Yes, exactly.
How is it like yoga?
Well, yoga is the union of the mind and body in order to experience the soul. That's the true definition of the word, union. You know, as you find a rhythm with the walking and the breathing and the sort of aware of the silence, and initially you feel the energy raise from the bottom coming up, and for me it's settled in my between the solar plexus and my heart chakra as I'm walking. Yes.
And is that good? Is that where you want it?
It's not a case really of what I want. You just be aware of what happens, and but I'm very happy with what's going on. Yes. Over the moon, as we say in England. Yes.
This sound could be a yak dung fire inside a stove, or rain falling on a roof, but it's the wind ripping through 1,000 prayer flags on the north side of the mountain. I look up and see the full-on north face and the summit, less than 2 miles away, a mile above my head. Only two people are said to have been on top, Buddha and the Buddhist saint Milarepa, but they didn't climb up. Buddha flew as a black-necked crane, and Milarepa rode on the first rays of the morning sun. This is supposed to be the most powerful spot on the circuit around the mountain. It's said that from here, the gods and spirits are so close they can hear your prayers, and as you make a wish, they'll do everything they can to make it come true. I wish for more oxygen. At 17,000 feet, my cells are getting only half what they get at sea level, and they don't like it. Everything's supposed to be coming together at this point, but I have a headache between my eyes. At night, we sleep, or try to sleep, in a two-man tent below the mountain. I somehow lost our water filter, so we have less than a quart between the two of us, and I didn't eat very much for dinner, and my sleeping bag is basically a nylon sack with a little bit of down, perfect for summer nights in the Utah desert, but it's not working at 17,000 feet. Every time I fall asleep, I dream I'm suffocating and wake up gasping for air. Then I have to struggle and concentrate on each and every breath, inhaling, exhaling, until I relax and go back to sleep, only to dream I'm suffocating and wake up gasping for air. So I get up and go for a walk. The tent is covered with frost. The air bites my teeth. I look up at the sky and am immediately attacked by infinity. The Milky Way is a thick white blanket that offers absolutely no warmth. The moon coming up over the mountains to the east is only a sliver, the thinnest excuse for a moon imaginable. The stars are needles in my eyes, and the mountain is luminescent and looming against the darkness. I walk over to the stream to get some water, but the water has frozen like clear, hard muscle stretching over rocks. I feel like the mountain has its foot on my chest and is trying to kill me, which is somehow a relief. Once I realize this, I feel much better. I walk back to the tent, eat a Snickers bar, and go to sleep. In the morning, we begin the hardest part of the walk around the mountain, the trip up and over the Domala Pass at close to 19,000 feet above sea level. On the trail, there are four Tibetan pilgrims, three men and a woman, prostrating themselves around the mountain. They have aprons of carpet hanging over their chupas and Chinese house slippers on their hands. They stand with their hands or slippers clasped at the forehead, then at the throat, then at the heart, praying for refuge. Then they bend down and slide their slippers out in front of them along the ground until they're lying flat out, and they pray again. Then they get up, step one body length forward, and pray again. It will take them 6 or 7 days to go around the mountain this way, and they have no sleeping bags or water bottles, not even any food that I can see. People have been coming here, doing this, for thousands of years. The top of Domla Pass is shaped like a smooth saddle, but it feels like a bone, maybe a skull cap, or maybe it just feels like death. The pass is close to 19,000 feet above sea level, a rocky and barren foreign planet. And in the distance, there are mountains after mountains after mountains, and all the space in between. The more I look, the more I disappear. Cheyenne Dorje, the 61-year-old man I met yesterday, has made it to the pass with his extended family. He's climbing up on top of a big boulder that's like a symbolic horse. His grandson is helping him, and the women are offering advice and criticism. He gets up on top, throws a leg over the ridgeline like he's sitting in a saddle, and bends down to touch the rock with his lips. Do you like the lake?
Yeah, I love the lake.
These women, also on top of the pass, are from a yoga center in Bihar, India.
Part I really liked was going around Lake Manasarovar, and it was felt very peaceful and very open in the heart, so that was wonderful. And this is hard physically, but it's just wonderful to be here.
In yoga, you're trying to uncover your truth, work through your fears, work through the difficulties. And this is a very good analogy of that, overcoming that. For me personally, I have a history of asthma, so to go without breathing It's been a big thing. But whatever's meant to be will be. If I don't make it, I don't make it. I'll try again.
We have made this journey as a pilgrimage. We have not made it as a mountain climbing expedition. We don't care about mountain climbing expeditions. We have made it as a journey to experience the highest goal of consciousness. We all felt it since we got the first sight of the mountain.
This stream comes from a glacier on the east side of the mountain. From here, the water runs down the canyon into Lake Mansarovar, then south across the Tibetan Plateau as the Sutlej River, down through the Himalayas, across the Punjab, emptying into the Arabian Sea. Then it will come back as clouds and fall as snow and freeze into ice that will eventually melt and run into this stream, a circle. 80 miles to the west, there are streams like this one that become the Indus River. 100 miles to the south, there are streams like this that flow into the Ganges. And 60 miles to the east are the headwaters of the Brahmaputra. These four rivers drain the Indian subcontinent. And in this way, this mountain is like a heart, and the rivers and clouds are like blood vessels, a circulatory system. Chinese scientists now say the glaciers in Tibet are melting at a rate of 50% every 10 years, which means that in 40 or 50 years, this circulatory system is going to disappear. From here, it's the long run out back to civilization. We'll follow the stream down the canyon, then get in our rented Land Cruiser and drive 4 days east across Tibet, then south through the Himalayas, back to Kathmandu. Back to traffic jams, dirty air, lots of problems and worry. The trick is going to be taking the mountain back with me to not let it disappear, so I can stand there in the middle of the worry and feel the mountain like a foot on my chest.
I'm Scott Carrier. Mount Kailash was produced with help from Stories from the Heart of the Land, heartoftheland.org. This is the roof of the world. Next stop, Nepal. That's in a minute on Hearing Voices. You're hearing voices on the roof of the world. This next half-hour piece is by Larry Massett, narrated by Joe Frank.
Siklis is a village in the foothills of the Himalayas. It doesn't appear on most maps, but it's part of the kingdom of Nepal, between India and China. Perhaps 800 people live in Siklis. Their homes are made from rocks plastered with mud. They grow rice and millet, keep chickens and water buffalo. In Siklis, there are no telephones, no electricity, no sewage system, no roads, no industry. Few Westerners have been to Siklis or even thought about it. Except to note that it's poor and badly in need of development. Siklis, on the other hand, thinks about the West all the time. In Siklis, they are working out their own ideas about Western development and the modern world. And this is a letter from Siklis. Kathmandu is the capital of Nepal. The center. Here there are roads, electricity, traffic jams, and hundreds of experts on international development. Foreign aid and consultants have come from the United States, India, China, Russia, England, Switzerland, and many other countries. The government labors through endless plans, papers, and conferences on development. But Nepal is not so much a nation in the Western sense as a collection of villages. The villages are cut off from Kathmandu and from each other by the mountains. They speak different languages, have different customs, different religions. The further you move from Kathmandu, the looser the threads holding together a country called Nepal. Siklis is a village far from Kathmandu. To get there, you can take a small plane west. After 2 hours, it lands in a cow pasture. Then you start walking in the direction of Annapurna. The path is steep, full of leeches, just wide enough for you to put one foot in front of the other. It goes through rivers and rice paddies and disappears in the rubble left over from landslides. Siklis lies at 8,000 feet. You can see it several days off. Your guide wants you to think it's just around the bend. Your feet hurt. When the clouds part, the Himalayas stand up and change the scale of the world. You are 3 inches tall. You are there when you hear the roar of the stream turning the millstones of Siklis. The stream drops 4,000 feet, and there are 30 or 40 mills grinding night and day. The sound follows you everywhere. You know what it is, but you keep looking up to see if a thunderstorm has come. The only person who speaks English is Chandra Prasad Gurung. He doesn't live in Siklis anymore. He is the head man's son, and he was sent off a long time ago to be educated in the modern world. Now he is back, doing research on his own village for a school in Bangkok. In the afternoon, Chandra sits with the old men on his father's porch. He takes notes. Later, he translates for you.
They could remember up to 70, 80 years ago what they were doing. They were still in a hunting state until 70, 80 years ago. It's very strange. They were not that much interested on farming. And then there's a very nice accident about how they got into the farming of millet. There was a very big famine in the village, so they didn't have enough to eat, and they, you know, people were here going here and there. So they go into the jungle somewhere else and then try to find a small flat land, and they dig it and then just sow some millet there. And then accidentally, you know, around that piece of land, it got fire, and the fire caught. Then they had a big plot of land there instead of the small one. And then when it was time for harvesting, they had so much of millet, they got 40 sacks of millet, and then they got rich.
Chandra is proud of Siklis. People grow their own food, make their own clothes, fend for themselves. They know life is hard, but their idea of an easy life is someplace flat with a highway.
They say people feel very, very separated from one place to another place, from town to the villages. Concerning about what they feel about Kathmandu, they always think that the people are happy there because there are good roads and they have easy life. And, you know, the same thing they think about America or some of the Western countries. Here they spend all their life carrying woods and carrying stones, carrying water, and everything they have to carry on their back. And they have to walk from one place to another place to do something else, whereas you don't have to walk in the town, and that's why they feel that it's very easiest life. I mean, they don't understand the social, you know, social problem what exists in the towns, but they always think it's a very easy life, very nice life. They think the important thing they think is that people in this city, they don't have to do work.
Chandra thinks he would like to come back to live in Siklis one day, I could do something to develop this town, he says. He shows you the sacred forest up the hill. A god lives in the forest, but there's a flat meadow at the edge. This is perfect. I'll build a hotel here, Chandra says. Hotel, mountain view. Look down and see the rooftops of Siklis. Look up and face the Himalayas. The tourists will love it. We'll charge a lot of money. And maybe at night we'll sing for them. But Chandra, you don't expect tourists to walk all the way up here. Well, no, he says. We'll make a highway so the bus can come. He thinks it over. First the bus, then the tourists, then the blue jeans and record players. Maybe it's not such a good idea, he says. Now we don't even lock our doors. And besides, how would I keep the tourists out of the sacred forest? These trees, the sacred ones, are almost the only trees in sight. Good firewood, Chandra says, is several days' walk from Siklis. Every inch of land is used for pasture or for crops. The hills are steep. Landslides are common. Everywhere, there are too many people. A farmer leads his ox round and round a field. Each year, there are more mouths to feed. Each year, his land yields less. If he tries to break new ground and plant more crops, he has to cut into the forest. That means less firewood, erosion, less topsoil. In the end, he's no better off than when he started. Sumitra Manandar is part of a team trying to map the hills north of Kathmandu. Day after day, with a notebook and a canteen, she walks from village to village.
Now, he is 50 years old, and as he remembers, he doesn't remember till he was 10 years old. Then he started to recall, and the peaks were all forested, the hilltops, the skyline. The hilltops were all forested. They used to hear that there are big trees, I mean, when they were children. But now as the people became more and more, and they wanted more and more cultivable land, they have been cultivating wherever it's possible. Within these 15 to 20 years, they have brought under cultivation the land amounting to now 600, about more than 600 sacks of paddy land. Paddy and all the crops. And I was asking if that's enough for them now. They said, no, it's not enough, but there is no more land available. Now, I was asking, since when they started to have this landslide problem? I said, all the landslides, that one is about 12 years ago, that one is about 8 to 10 years ago, and now all these were about 7, 8 years old, and very recent ones. How many houses are about to be destroyed, damaged by the landslide? This very house is in danger because now there's this high steep slope from the edge, right from here. And so probably within 2-3 years this whole house might collapse. But on the other end there about 12 houses in total are in danger, which might be which might get damaged by the landslides. If it gets any bigger, then the house is going to fall down.
Sometimes farmers can halt the slides by piling up stones or changing the course of a stream. And sometimes they set off landslides on purpose to get it over with. Three brothers own a small, jagged hill, barren, littered with big rocks, crisscrossed by streams. The hill is gradually caving in. But it's all they own, and the sooner it collapses, the sooner they'll be able to farm the dirt at the bottom. They've rechanneled the streams to encourage landslides. Every morning they walk 3 miles from their home to attack the hill. Their weapons are water and a pickaxe.
The water coming from, it starts all the way from the back there. And the water comes down this way, and it's diverted that way. And they try to flatten it out a little by little every day.
How long have they been doing it?
Kati barsa bhare yo garna?
Yo ba 3 barsa chalyo.
3 barsa yeso garna thalera?
यो त
यो गर्नलाई अहिलेको वर्ष मात्रै
भयो यो त धेरै नै जानी भयो धेरै अब यो अलि बसाल दिन सके माथिको चाहिँ बसाल चाहिँ जाने हुन्छ भने जति बसाल नि हुन्छ
यो यसो गर्न थालेको त भन्नु गर्न थालेको कति भयो
अहिलेको वर्ष मात्रै हो
अहिलेको
तपाईले फसल नै नो सिन्स लास्ट इयर आई दिस इज स्टार्टेड टु फॉल डाउन सिन्स 2 इयर्स बिफोर बट इट बिकेम वेरी स्टीप एन्ड नाउ दे आर ट्राइङ टु फ्ल्याटन इट द टप एन्ड सो दे आर डेलिबरेटली सेटिंग दिस अफ सिन्स लास्ट इयर बट व्हेन दे आर वर्किंग हियर लास्ट इयर
यो अस्ति आउँदा त झन्नै यो
एन्ड द स्टोन्स जस्ट फेल डाउन सो सडनली एन्ड ही इन्जर्ड हिज लेग एन्ड ह्याड टु बी ऑपरेटेड दैट कॉस्ट अ लॉट अफ मनी they can make small plots of terraces so that they can cultivate corn and millet. Few days before, when he was trying to dig that ditch, this stone fell down. And before this big stone fell down, there's some sound he heard while he was working, and he suddenly ran away that way. And this big stone fell down. If he hadn't ran that way, he said, I wouldn't have died.
So
don't go near them. It might fall down because it's just loose sand. I saw that what they're trying to do. I felt this is impossible. It's just their dream. But now it really works, you know. Yeah, they're going to let the top fall down. But that will take time. Maybe more 2 years or something.
The water, eating away at Nepal, could, in theory, save the country. If they had the money for big hydroelectric systems, the Nepalese could export energy on a grand scale. They don't have the money. Another theory says, shrink the birth rate. If you can't make more land, make fewer people. That sounds good to the government. But farmers need children to help with the work. Their children die young. To the farmers, birth control doesn't make sense. So the government does what it can, bit by bit. Anything helps. The sign rises on sticks from a field of mud. The sign says, "This is a community forestry development project. Here, a nursery has been established in this year, 2037. Chandra Depla Karnal runs the nursery. He's supposed to grow seedlings and hand them out to local farmers. Right now, he's showing his work to a pair of Western supervisors. He's a bit uncomfortable, and so are they.
This is our nursery, yes, sir.
Yes.
This is seedling of Pinus roxburghii, and this is Melia agaret. In Nepali, name Bakaino.
And for which purpose is it being used? For timber or for fodder?
For fodder also and timber also.
Mm-hmm. How many did you produce?
I have produced perhaps 250.
250 already in a...
It's all going well till the topic of apples comes up. There aren't any apples in the nursery, and Mr. Karnal wants to know why he can't have them.
Apple also yes. Wants.
Yeah. Then you get into the business of horticulture.
Yes, horticulture.
Let's say we have here a bit of a problem that where does forestry stop and horticulture start? The villages, very often they want to have species that can produce fruits which they can sell on the market. But our program supports the distribution of trees that are basically forest trees but produce also fruits like walnut and castania sativa.
Chestnut.
And some of those.
Is there someone else who specializes in apples and...
Yes, there's a horticulture department, and this is a thing we are going to monitor also in the next coming, in the coming few years, whether the people realize that there are different government departments.
I can also produce that from fruits,
mm-hmm.
But I have no seed.
You don't have the seed, yeah.
If I have seed and I can germinate that seedling and plants are distributed in village, but I have no seed of fruits.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I can grow that
you can
fruits.
Grow. Okay.
Yes, sir. If I have seed, I can grow.
Uh-huh. We'll discuss that later because success of such a project depends on cooperation with a lot of other departments.
The Western advisors are in for a disappointment of their own when they set out to inspect the seedlings given to a neighboring farm. A long, soggy path takes them through several flooded brooks and lands them on a steep bank. The mud is slippery. The weeds are magnificent. No one has told the farmer that small trees are a fragile crop.
That is Pinus roxburghii. This is Pinus planted here.
No.
Pinus.
Do you come and give advice?
Yes, sir. I have advice to him.
Uh-huh. What about weeding afterwards?
Yes, sir. And it's planted with.
I think that's very good that he does it. He has taken his plants, but. If he doesn't do some weeding...
Yes, sir. Weeding and cleaning.
All the effort is lost.
Yes, sir. Right? Yes, sir.
Would it be possible to put some kind of pole beside the plant so that you could find them afterwards?
A stick.
Small stick or something.
A smaller stick, yes, sir.
It's very, very difficult to find those small plants when the grass is growing.
Maybe it's a bit of... a task of you to go around and to check with them
weeding.
Yeah, that they do some weeding.
Yes, sir. Right?
Because these trees should not be wasted.
I have given to him these weedings is very most important
you,
for
you
plants.
You told them, yes.
Most important. Yeah. Yes, sir. So weeding is very most important.
Mm.
Yeah.
The deforestation of Nepal is advancing so rapidly that by one United Nations estimate, there will be no forest left in 10 years. Chandra's not convinced the development experts can do much about the problem. The village of Siklis, he claims, can manage on its own. It always has. Chandra himself has seen big cities in the West. The factories, the wealth, the slums, the confusion. He's not opposed to what the West calls development. Surely it's good when the gross national product goes up. It's good when the infant mortality rate goes down. When statistics say more people are learning to read and write, that's good too. But, he adds, life in Siklis is also good. It's not a question of statistics. A god lives in the forest nearby. There is mystery. There is good luck and bad luck. Life is full of accidents. Chandra had a sister named Lakshmi. She was beautiful, they say, clever, and like Chandra, they sent her away from Siklis. She traveled in Europe, went to school in England. There had never been anyone like Lakshmi. She was the miracle of the future. Last year, when Lakshmi got sick, her family thought the faith healers and folk medicine of Siklis weren't good enough for her. They sent her to the modern hospital in Kathmandu. The hospital treated her and released her. She died the next day. Her family doesn't blame the doctors or the Western medicine. It's no one's fault, they say. Just an accident. Lakshmi's mother shows you a metal box. She opens it and pulls out photographs one at a time, kissing them. Lakshmi. She shows you the gold earrings, the heavy jewelry. Lakshmi. At the bottom of the box is a cassette, which she hands to you. You put the cassette in your tape recorder and push play. The tape is old, stretched. It sounds like an amateur recording of English folk singers. Lakshmi mailed this cassette from England one time, Chandra explains. We think Lakshmi's voice is on it. You keep listening. You know it's not your fault. You haven't broken the tape. You didn't make Lakshmi disappear. When it's finished, everyone is extremely polite. We must have been thinking of some other cassette. Don't worry. It's just an accident. Chandra is leaving soon, back to school. At night, in his room, he listens to the short wave.
The port has been the subject of crane and counter-crane by the opposing forces. There are says, and holding the city...
There's fighting in the Middle East. In Kathmandu, the price of kerosene will go up. How long, he wonders, does it take to build a highway? Siklis is far. The world is close.
I would think that we got to learn a lot from the Western countries. But I personally feel that we have a very rich culture and we got to preserve this. Because people never been to the West, never exposed to the West. They really feel that West is the biggest thing, West is the beautiful, West is rich, West is easy life. And we got to do like, you know, what Western people have been doing. To preserve this culture, people have to know the some of the bad things, not only the good things of the America or the Western countries, but some of the bad things what's been happening. Maybe instead of developing the way it's been developed in the West, that we could develop the country in a somewhat different way in which we can preserve our culture and keep the balance. People are still happy.
Letter from Siklis was written and produced by Larry Massett. Technical director, Flawn Williams.
This is Hearing Voices from NPR, the best of public radio. I'm Scott Carrier of the Communication Department at Utah Valley University in Orem. UVU.edu. Go Wolverines.
From NPR, National Public Radio, this is HearingVoices.com.